You are listening to an encore presentation of the Talking Feds podcast. For more episodes, please go to Apple, Spotify, Amazon, or wherever you get your audio entertainment.
Before we jump into the show, I wanted to take a minute to tell you about an exciting upcoming event. You may remember that I launched a live speaker series in March called Talking San Diego. You can get all the info for that at talkingsandiego.net. But with the success of our first event with Congressman Jamie Raskin, we are keeping it rolling. On May 15th at 7 p.m. at University of San Diego's Shiley Theater, I'll be in a conversation with MSNBC host and former White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki about her new book, Say More, and other parts of her varied and exciting professional and personal life. I can't wait to bring Jen to the San Diego stage, and I really hope to see some Talking Feds fans there. To purchase tickets and for more information, plus an opportunity to get a signed copy of Jen's new book, click the link in the episode description. Thanks for listening. Welcome to Talking Feds, a roundtable that brings together prominent former federal officials and special guests for a dynamic discussion of the most important political and legal topics of the day. I'm Harry Littman. It was a remarkable, historic week, the first full week of evidence in the first trial ever against a former president. I had the great privilege of being present in the courtroom. And this week, I'm accompanied by two stalwarts of Talking Feds who, like me, bore witness to history, and a very experienced New York State prosecutor who's been following the trial closely. As you'll hear, our discussion analyzes the high points, stress points, and pivot points of the trial, but it also attends to important nuances that most accounts have missed due to the trials not being televised. Details such as the reactions and overall attentiveness of the jury, the soft-spoken but hard-fisted control of Judge Merchan over the proceedings, and the range of reactions from Trump himself, including his not-infrequent naps. The headline of the week was the prosecution's successful use of former National Enquirer CEO David Pecker to lay down the tracks of the overall narrative, emphasizing the goal of burying information of Trump's sexual liaisons in order to avoid harm to his presidential campaign. Pecker brought the story all the way up to the beginning of the Stormy Daniels episode that triggers the criminal conduct in the case and that the DA will pick up starting this week. We focus as well on the important side drama of Judge Merchan's efforts to bring Trump to heel and the coming reckoning for Trump's multiple brazen violations of the gag order that the judge imposed. What follows is a little raw and rough, but that's because it is also more than a little genuine. The immediate reaction of two expert commentators and me, all of whom were in the room where it happened, and a former senior official in the New York DA's office. And they are. Karen Friedman Agnifilo is an attorney, CNN legal analyst, and co-host of the Legal AF podcast on the Midas Touch Network. Karen previously served as Chief Assistant District Attorney in the Manhattan District Attorney's Office under Cyrus Vance Jr. Norm Eisen is a Senior Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institute and the founder and chair of the States United Democracy Center. He served as Special Counsel to the House Judiciary Committee from 2019 to 2020, and as U.S. Ambassador to the Czech Republic from 2011 to 2014. His latest book, Trying Trump, which focuses on this very trial, is now available for purchase. John Alter is an award-winning author, filmmaker, columnist, and MSNBC political analyst. Okay, so we want to really sort of, bear down on what's been going on. Let's start with David Pecker, who finishes his direct today. We're taping on Thursday. What about on the direct? You know, as expected, a lot of damage or, you know, just sort of set the table. How do you think it went based on expectations? Anybody?
This 2016 election interference case is the same pattern as the 2021, deceiving voters to grasp power and covering it up. And David Pecker went first for a reason. He turned out to be the star witness for the prosecution. If he can survive cross-examination, we'll come to that. And he gives you, the hardest thing in this case is to prove Trump's criminal intent. Was this just a routine non-disclosure deal like they do all the time, or was it intended to boost his campaign? And Pecker takes you through all five acts of the drama of election interference, of corrupt election influence.
All right, and we'll go through them. Well, go ahead, John.
Well, I think that, I'm not sure that the jury is necessarily going to buy that it's illegal trying to influence an election. In the opening statement, Todd Blanche, he landed with a point saying, this is democracy, right? The other reaction that they're going to have is, wow, this is a sleazy business. This guy is a scuzzy journalist, and he shouldn't even be called a journalist with this checkbook journalism and printing all these bogus stories about Trump's rivals. But I do think it sets the table. It's like a dress rehearsal so that when Michael Cohen is the witness on the actual crime, the falsification of the business records, it fits into a pattern of the way they operate. And Cohen is not all on his own, because a lot of what Pecker is doing is corroborating in advance, testimony that Michael Cohen will deliver. So there's been all this talk about how Michael Cohen, he's a terrible witness, he's a liar. Well, Pecker is not really, he doesn't come across as a liar. He comes across as an older, sleazy tabloid journalist who is corroborating an awful lot of the meat of this case.
Yeah, I thought, Taryn, he was, if anything, like a very forthcoming, affable, yeah, we broke the law, yeah, this is how it worked. he was a very kind of easygoing witness. What was your impression of Pecker?
Well, first of all, thank you for allowing this former state prosecutor onto Talking Feds. Look, I wasn't in the courtroom. I've just been reading the cold transcript. So those of you who were there and got a sense of it, I think it's invaluable. So I thought Pecker was absolutely crushing witness for Donald Trump. I assumed, and at my own peril, I just never gave him any credence. I thought he was just going to be context. He had nothing to do with Stormy. He was paying off people that wasn't illegal. And so he's just going to give a background and kind of a warm up almost, just to kind of warm up the jury, give the context and background and set up for Michael Cohen. But wow, I was blown away by this testimony. He sets up the whole criminal scheme. He is a co-conspirator, and he set up the criminal scheme. And the criminal scheme was a conspiracy to violate election laws. In fact, he said over and over again that he knew that they violated election laws. And there was a really, really significant piece of evidence that came in today as a contemporaneous text message between him and Dylan Howard, his deputy, his number two, where, and again, it's not a he said, she said kind of thing. This was a text message sent at the time. And the prosecutor, Josh Steinglass, did a great job at corroborating that. It's one thing to catch and kill stories for people. But when you're doing it as part of an election to influence an election, then you have to declare that money. If you're paying people off, that becomes an election violation. And this contemporaneous text message says that Dylan Howard wrote to David Pecker. It said, essentially, at least if Trump wins, I'll be pardoned for election fraud, because they were so worried about the fact that they were committing election fraud. And I think that he talked a lot about these meetings that they had to discuss this. And so he wanted to get paid back, because then it might not be election fraud, right? Then it's just influencing an election the way you're allowed to do in a democracy. But then when he got stiffed, he didn't get paid back for the doorman. He didn't get paid back for Karen McDougal. When they got to Stormy Daniels, that was a bridge too far for him, A, because she's a porn star in Walmart, his biggest customer, doesn't like porn stars and doesn't want him to be in bed with her. So he's like, I'm not a piggy bank. I'm not paying this money. And I'll do it for you if you pay me back, but you don't pay me back. So you have to handle this yourself. So that's where it turns into a conspiracy to commit a fraud. And he could say all he wants. He didn't think this was a crime. David Pecker was given a non-pros agreement by the feds and a cooperation agreement by the state. So if there was no crime here, the state investigated this. They prosecuted Michael Cohen for this. He went to prison for it. David Pecker was given a non-pros for it. So Donald Trump can say all he wants. This isn't a crime. There's so much consciousness of guilt in these statements, in these co-conspirator statements that have come in, that, wow, he sets up the crime. And the falsification of business records, that's just the cover-up. Yes, that's the charge, because that's what we have in New York State, and it's the easiest to prove. My theory is, because Donald Trump only attacks Michael Cohen and Stormy Daniels, we all just kind of thought, oh, this is a dumb false business records case with a porn star. Hush money, hush money, hush money. And we all dutifully went along that way. But as we were digging into this, a light bulb went off, and it actually went off, Norm, when I read your New York Times piece about it, when I read how Donald Trump won by 80,000 votes in 3 swing states, period, full stop. And how in 2016, people weren't desensitized to his scandals. It was a big deal. And they were doing everything they could to suppress this. And this was the scheme. This was the election scheme. And they succeeded, and he became president. So to me, they did the best job today at spelling that out and proving it. By the time they get to Michael Cohen, I mean, Michael Cohen is not that important anymore at this point. So, there were multiple times, by the way, that Pecker said, I spoke to Trump. Trump was in the room. Trump thanked me later. Trump had a dinner for me later. Trump invited me to the White House. So I think all of those connections where it was him and Michael Cohen were very, very effective. I also think, to answer your question, is how do I think it came across that he actually thinks that Trump is his mentor and has no animosity towards him? That's incredibly effective. Because Michael Cohen, by contrast, has a vendetta against him. So this guy, this is his friend. He's just telling the truth, right? And he's not making it worse than it is, and he's not making it better than it is. He's telling the truth about the things that they are.
The Dylan Howard text to a relative, I think it was, about how like he can get pardoned for fraud. Like, that has not been admitted yet. That was with the jury out of the room, out of the courtroom. So the lawyers were arguing about whether that is admissible.
That's a great point that I missed because I wasn't in the courtroom, but that's an excellent point.
Yeah. So the clarification that I'm hoping you can, you know, shed light on relates to New York state law. And this is what I think a lot of people have been wondering is the scaffolding of New York state law strong enough to support them going for conspiracy? And what do they do about jurors in the jury room saying, well, if it's a conspiracy, why didn't they indict him for conspiracy? Which with two lawyers on the jury is a question that will come up.
It's a question, though, and this goes to your point earlier, John, about whether he's charged with election interference for these felony document falsification counts, these 34 counts, to be felonies. There has to be intent to commit, aid, or conceal another crime. You don't have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt all the elements. All you have to prove is that Trump had criminal intent. That's one of those three statutes. All three were in the opening statement. That's New York law, and that's Norman. Normal. I'm Norman. That's Norman. Yeah. And Karen has a wonderful example drawn from burglary. Karen, why don't you answer John's question by explaining the burglary example?
Well, it's two questions. One's conspiracy. And the thing about the conspiracy question is it's a good point about why didn't they charge conspiracy. And I have a theory, which is this is an E felony, which is the lowest level felony. And so conspiracy to commit an E is actually an A misdemeanor. And so number one, the statute of limitations would have run on an A misdemeanor. And number two, you don't want to charge a misdemeanor when you have felonies because you don't want the jury to compromise. And you don't need to charge conspiracy to get the benefits of all the co-conspirator statements and all the conspiracy law, especially because the state election crime that they're using to bump up the business record has conspiracy built into the language of the crime. It's actually conspiracy to commit election fraud. So their theory very much involves conspiracy in two different ways. And so you're right, though, that I think the jury charge will definitely settle that for the lawyers on the jury, but that's to be determined. What Norm's asking and what he wants me to explain is there's a lot of people who in the beginning were like, well, how are they going to prove what crime and what crime is it? And, you know, how does that work, et cetera? And it's a general intent is what it is to commit a crime that they have to prove. And if you look at the jury charge for burglary and you look at how burglaries are charged, and I've actually confirmed this with several retired New York State judges since, because we've been talking it through, because this is really the issue that a lot of people struggle with. And the answer is, if a burglary in New York is essentially a trespass, which is a misdemeanor, so you enter knowingly and unlawfully to a location without permission and authority, that's just a trespass, which is an A misdemeanor. And what turns it into a burglary is if you have an intent to commit a crime therein. And so let's just say you have a guy coming into an apartment and he walks in and the door opens the door and he's holding his toothbrush and a sleeping bag and a pillow. And he says, well, I'm just looking for a place to sleep. You could only charge him trespass. You couldn't charge him with burglary, even though it's trespass in a dwelling. But let's say that same guy opens the door and instead of carrying those items, he has a safe cracker and he has burglar's tools and he has a condom and sex toys and whatever, all that kind of stuff. And he gets caught as soon as he sets foot in the door and he gets arrested for burglary. We would charge it as a burglary with an intent to commit a crime therein, but we wouldn't necessarily commit to which crime because we don't know what he was going to do. He might have wanted, you know, we don't know what his plan was. He could have done this or that or the other thing. But you can infer a crime based on a general intent. So that's how they charge burglary. And I pulled the criminal jury instructions for burglary, and it's consistent with that. Where it gets complicated is if the prosecution locks themselves into a theory, then they have to prove that.
I want to start moderator's control. I need to go back to Pecker and talk facts first, and then talk about some of the gnarly legal issues. So one, I just want to reaffirm what you were talking about, Karen. I found out today, that there was a sort of mystery. Why did Pecker kind of get off the train when it came time to Stormy Daniels? And we learned a narrative that he got heartburn over McDougal specifically because his lawyers told him, you're messing with a campaign violation.
Right.
And so that to me, really, so I thought, did they have some kind of parting of the ways or fight? No, he understood that there was a campaign violation there. And that very much reaffirmed the kind of theme of why are we doing this? We're doing this to help Donald Trump's campaign.
And also, but, I mean, this is, I think you're on a central point of today, because in the jury's mind, it's establishing that if you pay somebody hush money, that is an in-kind contribution.
Yeah.
Even layman jurors know that it's not just writing a check to a candidate, that there are other ways that you can help a candidate that constitute, you know, a major campaign contribution, and that this guy that they're looking at almost went to jail for doing that. And so they're wondering, well, why shouldn't Trump, you know, be convicted? Because he was involved in the same thing. So that takes you into campaign finance in a way that is part of the narrative. It's not a kind of a abstract, campaign violations. It all is very natural coming out of the narrative that Pecker was describing.
Yeah, I really agree. Yeah. And it makes, we have a really logical progression from Dino the doorman to Karen McDougal and now to Stormy Daniels. And also, it's very much anchored around just one more quick point of the real crisis. And Pecker knows all of this. Pecker, Cohen, Trump know all of it. He again and again had specific meetings and conversations that put Trump right in the middle, that the Access Hollywood had been such a crisis. And now when Stormy Daniels comes forward, they're really freaking out. Norman.
Yeah, I'm just agreeing with you, but organizing it into the five acts of the conspiracy followed by an epilogue, the cover-up. The five acts are the Trump Tower meeting, which we're going to talk about. That was the centerpiece of the cross-examination, which kind of fell apart at the end today, a little embarrassing for Trump. So you have the Trump Tower meeting, August 2015, formation. Pecker testified. We agreed to, as you say, commit a campaign.
Trump summoned me.
Yeah, to break the law. It was a criminal election interference conspiracy. Then you have the execution of this conspiracy. Act 2, Dino the doorman. Act 3, Karen McDougal, proving its existence, Trump's involvement. Then Act 4, the crisis. You need a very strong Act 4 to push you into Act 5 in Shakespeare. The crisis, Access Hollywood. Act 5, the solution, pay off Stormy before she causes a second. It was already a disabling crisis.
So, and who dies at the end?
So, well, that's what will be determined
when we talk about
the cross-examination. Yeah. So I think if you see it that way, there's a linear quality, is a simplicity to what the prosecutors are doing. And Pecker checked off all of those boxes. He didn't execute on Stormy, but he was involved in Stormy. He gave you everything else. And he even gave you a little bit, not today, but Tuesday. The days blur together. They're so long. And I'm toggling between cities. But Tuesday, Pecker testified about that he saw Trump's, or maybe it was Monday, he saw Trump's document handling practices. He was there.
Oh, meticulous.
So he brings in the packages. He looks at the invoice. Yeah. He inspects. He signs the check. So he even gives you the cover-up. Right. Devastatingly effective witness until, you know, as Mike Tyson said, everybody has a plan until they get punched in the face. That's what cross-examination is.
Could be. One more detail. He makes it very clear. Never mentioned Melania, never mentioned the family. You know, Trump's in a general quandary here because it's very hard for him. We don't think he's going to testify in any event. He could try to do it then. But now all he can do is try to suggest his version of things through their witnesses. And Pecker very strongly, I don't see what they're going to do with him on cross-examination. Just totally pulled the rug out from under the notion this is something to do with concern about, say, Melania.
Well, he did say a couple times that they were he was concerned about his family and the election.
But then the only time
he ever actually mentioned women at all, Trump, was when he said, "How's my girl?" about the 45-year-old at the time. That Karen McDougal.
She's a nice girl. And then she would play along.
And that, but a couple of times, on two different occasions, he's asking Pecker not just about whether she will stay quiet, but like, how is she? This is a guy who's denying that he had an 8-month affair, 10-month affair with her. And, you know, and that is his flat denial of having these sexual liaisons is totally ridiculous for the jury. So Trump goes into this whole thing with, you know, I think people believing from the opening statements that he's lying when he says he didn't do any of this.
Karen, impossible burden to carry, right? You know, they could have said, yeah, he's a sleazy guy, but not a criminal. Instead, maybe because of the influence of Trump right there, they could say
he's human like Bill Clinton. Right, they could have done a lot of things, but instead it's just the maximalist total denial. That's not
going to fly. But they did do the humanity point, and he's a husband, he's a father.
Yeah, but here's the problem with this, because I noticed that they did that. That is all in anticipation of making the argument that he didn't want this to come out because it would hurt Melania. The problem with that argument is that Cohen is going to testify, and he's going to have some credibility with what he says, especially since the table's been set by Pecker. Cohen is going to testify very clearly that Keith Davidson, representing Stormy Daniels, said, "Show me the money." And Trump said, this is in coming testimony in a couple of weeks, Trump said, "We don't have to pay her because it doesn't matter if it comes out after the election." In other words, it's not about embarrassing Melania. It's about winning the election. And then he will do what he did to vendors at Trump Tower. And Hillary brought it up in one of the debates. He stiffs people, right? He doesn't pay if he can get away with it. And he was trying to save $130,000 by getting through the election. But Stormy Daniels' lawyer said, "No, we need the money." And then they did have to give her the money before the election.
What do you think is coming next? Do they go from here to paperwork, or do they go from here to Karen McDougal and Stormy?
That's a great question. I've thought a lot about it, and I think it depends. I think it depends on when they're done with Pecker, because they're not going to want to put, say, Michael Cohen on Friday afternoon, right? And then give them the whole weekend to focus on it and prepare, et cetera. So if they, it depends on when they are done with Pecker is what I think. If they have a half a day, if the cross-examination ends tomorrow morning and they have a half a day, then I think they go to paperwork of some sort, or they start another witness. But I think Michael Cohen is sometime next week. I have a question for you. Do you think Stormy is going to be called as a witness?
I do, but I think they want to keep Cohen short if they can and in the middle.
What do you think about the contempt ruling? When can we expect that?
You know, that's just head scratching, right? Why hasn't he decided? And I think one theory could be that he's just waiting. He's sort of a little bit on the fence, right? That what are you going to do? His options aren't great. And so he's just letting them rack up and letting them rack up. And Michael Cohen did something, I think, really smart by saying, I'm not going to, because, you know, their big defense was, I'm just reacting to what other people are saying. Okay. So Michael Cohen took that off the table and said, I'm no longer going to be speaking about it. So maybe it's possible he's saying, let's see what he does now. Because now he can't say that. He can't say, I'm just reacting. Let's see how he does. If that stops him, right? If that actually stops him and he doesn't do this anymore, then maybe he'll just fine him and say, okay, keep going. But if he doesn't and he continues to violate it, I think you're going to see a sanction that he might put him in for a few hours or for the day.
Mucha, at the end of the day, he granted the order to show cause.
The motion didn't ask for jail.
That's right. I don't think they can start.
You don't have to ask. You know, that's what the prosecution's asking for. It's up to the judge. And some of these are happening in court. And that's a whole other contempt. So there's that the judge can utilize. He can utilize the judicial summary contempt if he chooses to, because some of these are happening while he's in court. And when he goes after the jurors, he has to control his courtroom. And so the judge may on his own do something else, depending on what Trump does.
He's going to start with money. But also, my understanding, maybe I'm completely wrong about this, is that if he jails him, that opens the door to a delay in the trial, not just the time he's in jail, but you know, there are appeals that are allowed when it's jail time, not fines. Trump could slow things down.
I think it depends on, again, there's three different types of contempt. It depends on which vehicle he utilizes. Again, if he puts him in for an hour, that's not going to delay anything, right? He just makes him sit there during lunch. That's not going to delay anything.
Karen, I know you got to go. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
All right, it is now time for a spirited debate brought to you by our sponsor, Total Wine and More. Each episode, you'll be hearing an expert talk about the pros and cons of a particular issue in the world of wine, spirit, and beverages.
Thank you, Harry. In today's spirited debate, we unpeel the truth about Pinot Noirs to see where the grapes shine best, Willamette Valley in Oregon or Burgundy, France. Here in the U.S., we classify our New World wines by the grape. Old World wines, like those in Europe, are classified by the region. In France, Burgundy is not only the region where Pinot Noir wines are from, but it's also the Pinot's ancestral home. No pressure, Oregon. To level set, Pinot Noir is a thin-skinned grape, which makes it difficult to grow, especially in warmer climates. Burgundy happens to have a cooler climate with ample cloud cover, making it the perfect home for Pinots. The cooler temperature allows the wines to ripen longer, giving the grapes extra time to develop more complex flavors like strawberry and dark berries to black tea and earthy minerality. Burgundy produces Pinot Noirs that are full of aromas and nuances. If we hop across the pond, we have Pinots from Willamette Valley in Oregon with similar cloud cover, climate, and soil composition as Burgundy. Oregon produces smooth and fruity wines that are slightly earthy and most definitely tasty, giving the region of Burgundy a run for its money. You can find all of these at Total Wine & More, where we have a huge selection of Pinot Noirs from Oregon to Burgundy, plus wines from every region in between. All that's left now is to reach up to our shelves and pluck one out for yourself.
Thanks to our friends at Total Wine and More for today's A Spirited Debate.
All right, guys, let's try to stick with the advantage we bring from having been there, okay?
Okay.
And you've been there from the start. So give me, you've been watching the jury. I have too just today. Let's start with them. What did you think when they were chosen? Is there any among them who you think might be a potential holdout? How are they striking you now in terms of their attentiveness, et cetera?
Well, when I'm in court, just as I do, I was taught actually as a young trial lawyer, which is when I first met Harry, when we were both youngsters, I was taught to have courtroom AWACS 360.
Right.
You want to know everything that's going on in the courtroom. Because sometimes, for example,
number three, not at his head. Right.
It's the judge, it's the jury, it's the other lawyers, the parties. You look behind you, what's going on? You know, these, I cut my teeth doing pro bono and low bono CJA cases in DC Super Court. And, you know, you want to see is a cop talking to another witness. You want to understand who's in the courtroom. That's how I watch what's going on in the courtroom. I think the jurors extremely attentive. They are surfing the rhythms. You know, they're settling into. They know, like, not every set of questions. You'll see them relax, and then they'll come to the edge of their chair. They're taking notes. About 10 of them ask for a paper, very diligently taking notes. They're much more alert than Trump, who fell asleep again today. I used Harry's binoculars to monitor his wakefulness or lack of it. You know, there are jurors on there who, there's one juror who was not aware that Trump was charged with four sets of felonies in four federal and state courts. There's another one who follows Trump's Truth Social.
He's a Wall Street guy who wants information about everything.
Right.
So he follows both Kellyanne Conway and Michael Cohen. He admitted he followed Michael Cohen on Twitter. Right. So you've got quite a number of well-educated jurors.
I think what's
important about that, and the fact that you have two, very unusual, you have two lawyers, you know, that's not, it used to be you couldn't get on at all if you were a lawyer in the old days. So what does that mean? Well, I don't have nearly your experience in any of this, but my gut tells me what that means is that if the conversation wanders off of where it should be, that the two lawyers and some of the other, you know, professionals who are on the jury will say, we need to listen to the judge's instructions. We're not freelancing here. And the judge told us twice that if we find him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, he used the word must convict twice. And he'll say something like that. He's basically saying no jury nullification. And so if somebody tries to play jury nullification games, they're going to get slapped down by some of the well-educated people on the jury.
Yeah. Let me make two more observations about the jury that I saw today. The first is you look for a point where the jurors, as they're coming in, have kind of cohered somewhat. They're laughing with each other. I saw none of that.
None.
I saw 12 individuals. The other thing, when they filed past Trump on the way out of the courtroom, no eye contact.
The way in and the way out.
Yeah, they do not.
Straight ahead, like they're soldiers. Soldiers for justice. They're like, straight ahead.
That's right. That's right.
It's really striking. Yeah. And then the other thing that's really striking, when they come in and, you know, the bailiff or whatever, all rise, and Donald Trump has to stand up for these 18, 12 plus six alternates, these 18 people. He has to stand up. And to me, that was a wonderful thing to see. You know, it tells you that, for now anyway, the system is still intact.
Yeah.
On this procession, there's three processions in this courtroom, and they're all very ceremonial. There's Trump comes in a highly formalized way with his Secret Service. Trump leads the way. You have a Secret Service in front. You have more mind, always for protection. You have the lawyers, and they were almost 20. And again, I like to look in every direction. I notice Trump's a comms guy, and he is a brilliant communications practitioner. Jason Miller and somebody who must work with Jason are in the procession. They peel off and sit in the back row of the courtroom. I know Jason from our shared CNN days. Then you have the much less formal procession of the prosecutors. They come in from a side door. They have a room off to the side. They come in. Steinglass is kind of the opposite. He led the way today. You can tell who's going to do the work on any given day because they have a big banker's box full of documents. So they come processing in, you know, much less formal. And then the third procession that you get is the jurors. And they are solemn. They are serious. And to me, that is a very good sign. They understand that they may be the only jury, because we had a
after the day especially
at the Supreme Court today. I know we're not going to talk about it too much. They may be the only jury to sit in judgment on Trump's alleged election interference. And they get it. To me, for the prosecutors, that's a very positive sign. An attentive jury, this funny intent issue under New York law, you need lawyers to explain it. It is valid. The lawyers will translate that. Some people say lawyers give you reasonable doubt, but I did. That has not been my experience in trying cases. Well, I like lawyers.
Who knows? I mean, there's one juror, his haircut makes me think he could be Trump. I mean, you know, you're just sitting there like looking at these guys and you're trying to find out things that you can't possibly
We're all, this is all like, so let's stick with it. I just think people who are listening in will like to hear our vantage point. So something else that struck me today, Mayor Chan has a fairly light touch, and something in particular, they don't have long involved arguments about objections. They say objection, he knows what they're talking about. If he doesn't, he brings them to sidebar and then just says one way or another, doesn't try to make it a mini contest who's going to win and who's going to lose.
That's about speed. I mean, this guy, he's got a case where Steve Bannon is the defendant that's supposed to start in June, and he doesn't want to have to delay that case. And he is really committed to speed. And that's been clear from the pretrial motions and from the first day I watched him. He's an excellent judge.
Yeah.
He really understands. I think he's
runs the courtroom. And he's not egomaniacal at all.
And I've been talking to some of the lawyers who've tried cases before him, and they have very positive things to say about him.
So I'll just say a word about the cross, and then we can move on. I thought Beauvais was doing a brilliant job with a lot of edge. And what he was insinuating was he was supporting the theory. You've done these non-disclosure agreements.
He got 100,000
times.
And he said yes.
Hundreds.
Oh, it was worse. 100,000 times.
Hundreds. Yeah. Hundreds. I wrote it down. Hundreds of thousands.
Hundreds of thousands,
So Peckers, he's hypnotized him. And the jury, you know, when you ask questions in that nasty way, it's a transfer. The jury says, oh, something's wrong with this witness. This guy's so suspicious. Then he went in for the end of the day kill, which was going to be, you changed your story because the first time when you talked to the feds years ago, you didn't say Hopix was in and out of the Trump Tower meeting. And now you do. You were influenced. And you're making this up. You had this litany. You're filling the gaps. And he had Pecker. And Pecker asked an innocent question. Can I see the document?
Right.
And he gave him the wrong document. Now, whether it was intentional, the judge said, look, I don't think you're... But it was a major boo-boo. If you're going to refresh a witness's recollection, and the witness asks you for a document, it better damn well be a document that's, you know, a litany that's about that meeting. And it wasn't about the meeting. The judge sent the jury home. He was really very forceful. And he says, when the jury, you have misled this jury into thinking and you've undermined. And the DA made us think about it. When they come back tomorrow morning, I'm going to tell them to disregard. And that is devastating.
I think it's a little more than disregard. He's going to say, that he gave them the impression that there was something in there and
Correct, it wasn't there.
So I thought it was a technically fine cross. Even in Peggy, it had rhythm, one fact per question, correct, had him say yes, yes to everything. I don't think it did a lot of damage. I don't think there's all that much damage to do to Pecker because he just, you know, gives up everything. This was the first time he bore in to try to do damage.
Yes.
And so the headline of the cross, it was, now we have two Trump lawyers who have got, you know, it's not quite as bad as he said to Todd Blanche, but two of them are, you know, have been slapped around pretty good, obviously, in front of Trump. That was a bad moment.
Before that happened, I was kind of thinking, and Michael Wolff, who's written two books, huge bestsellers about Trump, was making this point to me yesterday, that he thinks Trump is going to fire Blanche because he always has to find somebody to blame.
Right.
But he can't replace him with Bove now because he screwed up. I did think Bove scored on the Arnold Schwarzenegger Rahm Emanuel.
Explain.
It makes it harder to say this was some sinister Trump Tower conspiracy if Pecker has done this for 25 years, you know, and if it's just, and it's just standard in the business. And one of the really sad things is, like, yesterday, I saw a couple of middle school kids who had gotten into the courtroom as spectators, and they were being interviewed on MSNBC, and they were talking about how, oh, it's so terrible that the press works this way, and we learned a lot about bias in the press, as if the National Enquirer is representing all of us, you know, and which is a sad byproduct of this case. But I do think that by de-dramatizing the Trump Tower, so-called Trump Tower conspiracy, it gives jurors a kind of permission slip to minimize the whole conspiracy.
Yeah. All right. So now let's talk about Cohen. Actually, you know, I'm not sure if they put McDougal, there were details we learned about her that were new to me, that she really had this great ambitions to do ghost-written pieces and her own beauty products line or whatever.
Yeah.
Meaning, she, I can imagine her not having the greatest testimonial qualities. I don't mean to be disparaging. But what do you think, how and when do they handle Cohen? Let me ask your view on that, Norma, and I have one. And do you think we see either Karen McDougal or Stormy Daniels?
I don't think you're going to see Karen.
First name basis, huh? Nice girl.
She's a nice girl. That was devastating. I mean, the Pecker testimony was rich.
Karen McDougal.
So much. I think Karen is a little bit of a detour for the prosecutors here. They have what
There's
they
no
need.
Crime.
I mean, that's, you know, you run the risk of confusing. You, for sure, you'll see Stormy. But I suspect that what we're going to get to now is they've done their star opener. The defense is going to make them authenticate everything. They're asking Trump Organization for a document custodian, a third-party subpoena. You know, they're just going to do a kind of a baton death march. Do all, I would get it, all or almost all 95% out of the way. That's why we have 6 weeks of trial. I mean, you...
So they won't stipulate to any of that? I mean, what good does it do them? Just like...
Delay.
It's loss of drama. It's the ebbing of the... But it's very irregular. You know, and judges don't like it either, but they...
Do jurors like it? If it's like... Oh,
yeah, that's right.
Jury
the jury understand that it's... That
it's
while
the,
prosecution is going on and on, it's because the defense forced them to.
Yeah. I think Josh Steinglass is a very good prosecutor.
Yeah, I wanted to go to him. Give us your sense of him. Yeah.
Like, he was doing this thing with, you know, to try to authenticate some of the texts from Dylan Howard. I guess they were maybe from Australia or something, but they were somewhere abroad.
Yeah.
He kept asking Pecker to do the math on what time it was in New York when, you know, it was Greenwich Mean Time. Or I don't know what he was.
It was Greenwich.
Yeah.
Right.
But, like, who cares?
Right.
I know that he was trying to do that so that they couldn't argue that it was a fraud because, you know, nobody would be texting in the middle of the night or whatever. But that didn't. That didn't really seem necessary. And, I think the jury was kind of going like,
really? Maybe. Look, I think it's been an effective presentation for the reasons you guys have both said. It established the narrative and extended the narrative. It was a little long. I, you know, in general, that's the kind of constitutional defect of prosecutors, is not getting quite crisp enough. We had a lot of pecker, but, you know.
It's not like, you know, taking a testimony from an accountant. It's all fun.
And I got to say, he really struck me. I expected a guy who was either going to be a little bit reluctant to you know.
Oh, or, I thought he was going to be totally reluctant.
Right, to go get there. He was totally forthcoming. By the way, another little nugget that came out today, he hasn't spoken to Trump since 2019. Trump tries to reach out to him, and he's a little nervous and doesn't do it, even though he really likes him, considers him his mentor, which I think, as Karen was just saying, that's a good thing for the prosecution.
I mean, when Hope Hicks takes the stand, we're going to see what a reluctant witness is like. Yeah. And under the terms of his non-prosecution agreement, he could have still had a faulty memory. He could have gone up there. Instead, he's got the memory of an elephant.
It's really,
he remembers everything.
And about all his criminal activities. It's really true. Before we would do the sort of legal questions, especially the contempt stuff, any thoughts about anyone else in the prosecution team? Steinglass has been for... Surely
Steinglass,
number one.
They're going to rotate.
Yeah.
Pecker's an easy witness. So that's why you have three leads. Plus they have Chris Conroy doing the law stuff, including the contempt.
Yeah.
When you look at those two processions we were talking about, they are more leanly staffed than the Trump team, which is seemingly sucking in contributions from all over the universe.
There's all these 25-year-olds.
Normally, people think that, you know, the government gets outclassed. And Ty Cobb, one of Trump's former attorneys, said he expected that, you know, the prosecution would get outclassed by Trump's lawyers. Todd Blanche has a good reputation. Bove has a good reputation.
Yeah.
But that's not happening.
That's right.
It's much more even.
Yeah, I think that's right. I thought that, you know, I wrote for I'm doing a trial diary like the one you're doing for The Times and The Washington Monthly. I'm doing for CNN Opinion. And I wrote that I thought that Blanche brought his A game to his opening, but Colangelo was A+.
Yeah.
He has the facts and the law on his side, and he, you know, this case has come. People love surprises. The actual case is so much different than the imagined petty hush money case.
It's
legally fascinating. The witnesses have been powerful. The presentations have been first rate, and the stakes are enormous. Now, we're also seeing a drag in Trump's poll numbers when you look at the average. There is a legitimate question. Some very smart people, I'm not a pollster, but I play one on TV. I wrote an op-ed for the New York Times on these issues with two pros. People think the case is having a dragging effect, including our friend Jen Rubin wrote, because it makes Trump seem small.
Yes,
right.
And also, here's the other
thing. You might have written
and
that,
and he brings
well,
the
I,
heel.
I've written that.
Sit down, Mr. Trump. And he does.
Right. I mean, that was a striking
moment.
Yeah. Mr. Trump, please take your seat. Yeah. And here is a guy who, his entire life, he's never done what he was told. He was so disobedient that they sent him away to military academy. You know, he never listened to anybody about anything until now. And so now what is he doing? He's sitting down like the obedient boy he never was. If it's not humiliating, it's still striking. And I think there was a moment there, even if people didn't see it on TV, where there was like a power shift. And the power in the courtroom is Judge Merchant's. Trump's superpower is he's strong. And a lot of people, they admire what they see as strength. I think he's actually weak, but he projects strength. And if that goes away, he's in real trouble. I'll tell you something really interesting. He had to lie yesterday on social media and say that his supporters were not allowed in front of the courthouse. Because the reason he had to tell that lie was completely untrue, and that they had blocked off traffic to keep his people away, completely untrue. Traffic was going right through, right past the courthouse. The reason he had to say that is I've been counting how many pro-Trump protesters there are at the courthouse. You know how many there were this morning?
Seven?
Zero.
Zero.
You know how many there were on Tuesday? Zero.
Wow.
In the middle of the day, sometimes there will be five or six. And at the end of court today, there were three or four just screaming. Like, one of them was a mentally ill man who wasn't even pro-Trump, who self-immolated. But Laura Loomer is one of his, she's kind of like the Rabbi Korf of Trump, you know, the dead-ender supporter. Like, she comes up on the first day, she had about a dozen people with her, the first day of the trial. Then she tells the New York Times she has to go home to Florida to feed her dogs. And she says the other pro-Trump people are lazy. They want, they won't show up. He's got a lot of supporters on Staten Island. They are not getting off their hindies to come and support him. You could argue that even with his base, the support is a little bit, it's not soft because they're going to stick with him. They're going to vote for him. But they're not going to go riot on his behalf anymore. That ain't happening. And they're not even going to yell and scream in any numbers on his behalf. And his audiences at his events are not very good either.
You know, so I couldn't agree more. They, as people try to sort of analyze what has made him so effective to the extent he is, this sense of just sticking it to the, you know, doing whatever he wants and really rubbing his, you know, nose at anyone, that's, I think, a big part of it. And for him to be brought to heel, it's the worst possible look for him. I wonder then, maybe we should close off here, what your thoughts are. We haven't talked too much about Trump, except he was asleep a little. He was talking to his lawyers. You know, as in other cases, I'm thinking of the Tish James case. As things got worse for him, he acted up more and tried to contrive and manufacture a antagonistic relationship with the judge, somehow try to, you know, do something to change the dynamic. Does he just sit and take it? And
no, he's going to do something.
So you think he erupts? You think he erupts?
He's got to do something, not necessarily in the courtroom.
Yeah.
But he escalated this morning when I mean, he says, like, a threat to Pecker, be nice.
Yeah.
He says
he's saying that
to a witness? I mean, in what other case does somebody say to a witness who's on the stand, be nice publicly?
How many cases have you had? John, how many cases have you reported on it, where the defendant has had three orders to show cause? Three orders to show cause. You're not even 2 weeks into the trial.
Okay, but you see it also. I mean, we at least think he's trying to skate around the orders. Although you're right, and he should be held in contempt. So, do you anticipate then that the act of the trial, Act 3, whatever, is Trump going into full-blown, you know, spreadsheet of, on the walls kind of...
You mean, as Trump says, he's dared the judge. I'll be a modern-day Nelson Mandela. Put me in jail.
Do you guys both think he's going to go rip shit?
Reason points me one direction, instinct the other.
Yeah.
Reason tells me that Trump is going to continue to press the boundaries too, because he has to show. And, you know, he said, I'll be a modern day Mandela. But my instinct is that he's gone up to the edge. He's done 14 of these statements. Yeah. He won't dare do 15. That's my instinct, that he'll test it and push it. Because he's afraid the judge is going to put him in jail.
No,
step him back.
I mean, I think he doesn't want to go to jail. It's all bluster, but I don't think he's going to do that. I think he's going to dance right up to the line, and then maybe he'll go quiet for a week, and then he'll reoffend three or four more times. That just costs him another $3,000 or $4,000, and he'll kind of pace it so that he doesn't actually get thrown in jail.
I think all three of us are saying, I think maybe here's an end for this episode. We'll reconvene next week, perhaps in some fashion. I also tend to think, look, I agree, he tries to push on the boundaries when he's outside, shows some bravado, but I don't see him, you know, doing the kind of in-your-face attack that we saw him do with other judges, with Engoron and Kaplan. I mean, he really, you know, insults them. I think that dynamic, which was huge, I couldn't agree with John more, is going to stay that way. There's been a power shift that, and he...
Trump is cowed.
I do. I think
so. In the courtroom. Then he leaves the courtroom and he kicks over the traces.
Okay. Okay. But I'm talking about in the court. Does he somehow really torque it up? I think we have
not in the courtroom. But
his freedom hasn't been at stake before. Yeah. And that jury, he doesn't, you know, if that jury convicts him, then this is the judge who will sentence him. And he, and all of that is, it's in chapter 8 of my book, Trump. I may have a copy.
All right, and there you go. There's a man. We'll be back next week in the actual privileged pews watching the whole thing.
Yeah, we got lucky.
It's been great.
And I hope we're sitting together.
Yeah, we would be lying if we didn't say it is super fun.
It is super fun. And there's an end. All for one, one for all. All right. See you guys. Thank you so much.
We are out of time. Thank you so much, Karen, John, and Norm. And thank you very much, listeners, for tuning in to Talking Feds. If you like what you've heard, please tell a friend to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or wherever they get their podcasts. And please take a moment to rate and review this podcast. You can also subscribe to us on YouTube, where we are posting full episodes, talking books, and bonus video content. You can follow us on Twitter at TalkingFedsPod, and you can look to see our latest offerings on Patreon. Talking Feds is still a completely independent production, so if you like the work we do and are inclined to support the show, joining our Patreon is the best way to do it. You can now leave voicemails with your questions for me and our guests, whether for Talking Five or general questions about the inner workings of the legal system for our sidebar segments. All you have to do is call 727-279-5339 and leave a voice message. And you can still also email us your questions at questions@talkingfeds.com. Thanks for tuning in, and don't worry, as long as you need answers, the Feds will keep talking. Talking Feds is produced by Catherine Devine, associate producer Meredith McCabe, sound engineering by Matt McCardle. Our research producer is Zeke Reed. Rosie Dawn Griffin and David Lieberman are our contributing writers, and production assistants by Akshaj Turbailu. Our music is, as ever, by the amazing Philip Glass. Talking Feds is a production of DeLito LLC. I'm Harry Littman. Talk to you later.